This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
With our current level of carbon emissions, scientists worry we could go over 4 degrees C of warming in less than 100 years. The last time Earth warmed that much, the plants clothing the planet changed, along with the species. We know that because of new research just published in the journal Science on August 31, 2018. My journey through that paper was filled with exclamation marks and oh my God notes. Our guest, Dr. Jonathan T. Overpeck, was a major author in that work. Overpeck has been a lead author for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He has often briefed Congress on climate in the days when Congress cared about such things. He advises governments, edits scientific journals, and organizes conferences. He's published over 200 papers on climate and the environment. After a long career at the University of Arizona, Jonathan Overpeck is now with the School for Environment and Sustainability at the University of Michigan. Dr. Overpeck, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Good afternoon.
The new paper in Science predicts unimaginable things. It sounds like we're heading towards a different place where humans today would hardly recognize their surroundings. Is that possible?
Well, you know, when you look at the world, there are a lot of things that are kind of permanent, and those include mountains and coastlines, for example. But when you think about it, a lot of what we have on our planet is framed in terms of natural or managed vegetation. The plants we see, the ecosystems that they support. And that's what we focused on in this paper, and the fact that they are going to change a lot more in all likelihood than we thought before.
Just before we dive deep into the science, I note this one chilling phrase in the introduction. It says, ecosystem change is accelerated by mass mortality of incumbent dominance. Now, you're talking about plant life there, but we need plants for food. Am I crazy to wonder if under the worst climate scenario, humans may also be incumbent dominants that experience mass mortality?
Well, that wasn't the focus of the paper, but there are other works that have been carried out that suggest that mortality will go up among humans, particularly those that are less able to adapt in really rapidly changing situations. And just imagine, right now we're about 7 billion people on this planet, and the current projections are by 2050 to be at around 11 billion. So at the same time, we're going to have to be feeding and providing water and other life-sustaining resources for this large increase in people. We're going to be battling climate change and the impacts of that climate change that are probably going to, in many cases, reduce our ability to feed and to provide water and other essentials for humans to thrive.
Okay, so there are 42 authors listed in this paper, chosen from experts all over the world. Why so many authors?
Well, we had really two phases of this project. And in order to carry out the research, we needed to have expertise from around the world. The first stage was to look at the vegetation change that took place during the last deglaciation that started around 21,000 years ago. So we, in order to carry out this project, we needed expertise around the world. We're interested in studying the vegetation change that occurred during the last deglaciation and understanding the relationship between that dramatic vegetation change everywhere on the planet and warming that occurred and, in fact, drove most of that vegetation transformation. We're then going to use the relationship between the past temperature warming and the vegetation change to understand the way in which temperature can change vegetation. Then we're going to apply that to the future. And in order to do this and be sure we were doing it well, we needed expertise from around the planet so that we had expertise not just in North America, where I'm from, but we had expertise from every nook and cranny of the planet.
Right. It's an impressive list. People from China, people from just pretty well every biological system were there. And I wanted to ask you, how confident were your experts that the big changes observed in plant life then when the world warmed thousands of years ago was due to climate change?
Well, that's something we explicitly asked them to assess. We first wanted them to tell us what vegetation change occurred, both in terms of vegetation structure and composition. And then we wanted them to give us confidence estimates for that change. And then we asked them to estimate the degree to which temperature likely drove those changes. We didn't want to get in a situation where we were mixing changes that were, say, due to humans at the end of the deglaciation into the present day, or changes that were related to, say, CO2 increasing over the deglaciation, or maybe even precipitation change.
Right. Composition and structure are mentioned all throughout the paper and in the graphs, and unfortunately I had to go to the supplementary materials to find out what those key terms meant. What do they mean, and why break things down into those two categories?
Well, we wanted to get measures of vegetation change that people could relate to, and those terms are technical terms, but they're pretty easy to understand. The structure of the vegetation is the sort of the dominant form that the vegetation takes. For example, is it tree-covered? Is it deciduous trees or evergreen trees? Or is it a savanna, grassland, or desert? So these are big changes in the overall structure of the vegetation. The composition is a little more subtle. It's the change in the dominant species of plants that are growing in the vegetation. And a lot of people could understand this if you're in North America, say. Are you going to shift from a pine-dominated forest to a spruce-dominated forest? It doesn't take often as much climate change to change the composition, but to change the structure, it's usually a bigger change.
So as I understand it, long ago there was a warming of about 5 degrees centigrade, about what the worst scenario is now for the year 2100 or 2150, but it took about 7,000 years for that warming to complete its process. How worthwhile are your study results when we're comparing 7,000 years to 150 years of warming?
Well, what we're interested in is getting an empirical estimate of how big the vegetation change could be, meaning something grounded in real observations, as opposed to a model, which is all we've been able to do to this point, the scientific community. We wanted something grounded in real, this is what happened, data. And so we had to take this imperfect comparison and use it. And it makes our results conservative. So what I mean is, what we are looking at is what kind of vegetation change is likely for a given amount of temperature change. We wanted to see that in over the entire planet projecting into the future. And we can actually develop a functional relationship between temperature and vegetation change for this longer period in the past. But we do acknowledge that it's going to just all happen so much faster in the future. And that makes our results conservative in the sense of what's going to happen in the future is going to be a lot more chaotic and difficult to predict because it's going to go so fast. It's also going to be more chaotic because there's going to be changes associated with human land use, pollution, you know, and all sorts of other human activities that are going to work with climate change to really transform our planetary landscapes.
Now, as you know, some scientists suggest changes in atmospheric carbon dioxide alone can affect plant life, even without climate change. How did your study decide the big changes in plants were due to climate and not just more CO2?
Well, you know, the changes that occurred in the past undoubtedly have a small element of CO2 forcing. But what we did is we went to lengths to sort of review that literature about how CO2, and in particular CO2 increases that occurred over the deglaciation, affect vegetation. They weren't that large, about 30%, not that large compared to what we're doing now. And we concluded, based on the evidence, that CO2 effects on the vegetation change were secondary to temperature. Temperature is the dominant driver of this widespread or global reorganization of vegetation that took place on the deglaciation.
And according to your tabulation of global studies, some parts of the world will see greater changes than others. Can you tell us where some of the places where big changes will take place?
Well, the changes are ubiquitous, and I think this is to me, the most important finding. In previous studies, we found, not us, but the scientific community, using models of climate and vegetation, we found regions of large changes separated by regions of small changes. And what our new paper shows is that the change is likely to be everywhere. And that's what happened on the deglaciation. Almost everywhere changed. And as you say, some places will be less at risk of change than others. It turns out that the Andes in South America are a place that have proven because to be more resilient to these large temperature changes. But the higher latitudes, they're going to see the biggest change.
And that's where most of my listeners live, I would add. You've talked about the difference in the future plant world. Is it wildly different if we manage to stay under 2 degrees compared to going over 4 degrees C of warming?
Yes. If we cause a large-scale climate change, essentially by leaving our emissions of greenhouse gases at the current rate for this century, we'll see changes comparable around the planet to the last deglaciation in many cases. What we were able to do in this study is actually calculate the risk of major structural or compositional changes. And with business as usual emissions, the risks of major transformation are in the 60 to 70% range. Whereas if we were able to curtail the emissions of greenhouse gases to, say, the levels agreed to in the Paris recently, then many parts of the world would have a risk of transformation, compositional change, less than 50%. So it really shows in stark terms how an effort to curtail our greenhouse gas emissions could really benefit pretty much everywhere on the planet in terms of vegetation change.
How much does it matter that your study period began with extreme cold in glacial times, whereas we're starting with the warmth of the Holocene and heading towards a hothouse Earth?
Yes. One of the things that, like with the rate of change, that's a real wild card going into the future, real complicating factor, is that we'll be going not from glacial to interglacial, but we're going from interglacial to super interglacial, really hot world. Particularly if we don't curtail our greenhouse gas emissions, that many of the plants on the planet haven't seen in millions of years in their evolutionary history. And many of the climates we'll see in the future will be, therefore, so different from anything on the planet today that it'll be, again, very hard to estimate exactly what the changes will be. We just know they'll be large, and we don't know the exact pattern. So that'll mean a lot of difficulty in managing this change. And unfortunately, that just will make the impacts worse.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, American climate scientist, Dr. Jonathan Overpeck. We are talking about a big new paper titled Past and Future Global Transformation of Terrestrial Ecosystems Under Climate Change. And I noticed that in 2008, for example, we broadcast a speech of yours at the University of Washington. You talked about the drying of the West. And now here we are seeing many and more wildfires in the West. Our Canadian fire expert, Mike Flanagan, told us under certain conditions, the forest may not even return. And our government said that some of the forests in the south of BC will become grasslands instead. You've written extensively on the west of North America. What do you think is happening when it comes to wildfires and drought?
Well, what's happening in North America, western North America? I'm actually at a scientific workshop on that topic now, preparing a presentation for tomorrow. And there's a lot of debate as the Southwest Millennium Drought, a name that's not formally been widespread, but I think that's what you'd call it. It's been going on now for almost 19 years. And it all started back in 1999 when the big reservoirs on the Colorado were full, Lake Mead and Lake Powell, and the levels in those reservoirs have plummeted as drought has more often than not plagued the region. And you're seeing signs of the same change across the entire west of North America and down into Mexico. And what's really happening is, of course, we have precipitation deficits, and you know, drought is often thought of as a precipitation deficit, but what we're seeing more and more is a role of temperature warming in drying out the Southwest and the West generally. And this means the snow is melting earlier, and vegetation, forests, and soils have a chance to start drying out earlier. And this moves up the timing of the fire season, and it makes it much longer. And during that fire season, we're talking about wildfire and forests, the warmer temperatures are drying out the vegetation more. And in some cases, the effect of the warming and the drying has been so dramatic that it has literally killed trees outright. A good example of that is in the Four Corners region of the West, you know, primarily in New Mexico. And it's pretty clear now that temperature is just going to have a bigger and bigger effect on our vegetation. So we're getting this big uptick in tree mortality. We've seen it now, I mean, tree death. We've seen this in the Four Corners region. We've seen this in California now after their drought. We're seeing a big uptick in huge, severe wildfire. We're seeing more insect outbreaks as the trees are less able to fight off the insects and pests and pathogens because they're stressed by lack of water and warmth, but also because some of these pests and pathogens have more life cycles and other things that are favored by warmer temperatures. All of this together makes the Western United States, and particularly the Southwest, kind of like the canary in the mine shaft for this large-scale vegetation change we're going to see in the future around the entire planet. And you're not only seeing it in the Southwest U.S., but you're seeing it other parts of the world as well, for example, Western Australia.
And I'd like to read you one more sentence that really stuck out to me out of many in the paper. It says, quote, "Although many ecological responses like species migration, colonization, and succession will likely lag behind climate change, the transformations will often be accelerated by disturbance and land use and invasive species." Now, to me, that sounds like some of the climate conditions needed to support some species will have already changed before they move on and die. In other words, we may not really know what's happened until we see things start to disappear around us.
Yeah, I think one of the real concerns that we've stressed in this paper is the inherent unpredictability of the details of the change. But in order to get vegetation change, for example, you need to disturb the vegetation. You can get very slow change as new plants start to that are more favored by the warmed climate start to establish and grow within a forest, say. But you can change things much faster if you have a large wildfire, clears out the old vegetation and lets the new vegetation come in. And we're seeing that in this process already play out in the West. But we don't know exactly what's going to seed in there and how well it will fare before it becomes too warm for those new plants that are establishing. And, you know, the idea of these invasive species, these species that are brought in from afar, say from Africa. A good example would be down in the Sonoran Desert. We have these grasses that came from the Mediterranean and Africa regions, and these get into the desert. The grasses are very flammable, but yet the traditional desert vegetation that's been there for millennia is not adapted to fire. So you all of a sudden are going to really change the dynamics of the vegetation and how that vegetation will respond to climate. But it's going to be unpredictable.
And I think we could probably do several more studies just based on this one about what could happen for mass agriculture that's currently feeding the billions of current humans.
Yeah, you know, there's. I don't work on the agricultural side of climate change impacts, but it strikes me that one of the things that needs to be emphasized is that our natural vegetation provides a lot of services for humans. It's not just something pretty to look at, but it provides food, it provides fiber, think of it, building materials. It often is essential for water supplies to remain secure, and of course biodiversity and all the animals that live in the vegetation around the planet, some of which are sources of food, others are sources of pharmaceutical raw ingredients. These are all things that are provided by the natural vegetation of the planet that could be lost before we even know it.
And I worry that people are so disconnected from the plant world. I mean, kids may think food comes from supermarkets or maybe it's made in factories. And meanwhile, we're checking updates on social media and looking for shocking news. But what could be more shocking, Dr. Jonathan Overpeck, than to say that the whole plant world of this earth could change very rapidly due to our emissions?
It really should be a major headline. And you're just in the oceans, it's the same thing is happening as we, warming temperatures and acidification are destroying coral reefs around the planet and really affecting fisheries, sight unseen to most people who live on land. At least the vegetation change, when it starts to really pick up, is pretty clear. And I would say in the Western United States, most of us this summer even realize, you know, things are really changing. All the smoke that we had across the entire West really is a clear reminder of the kind of change we're talking about. People think of it as wildfire, out of control wildfire, but what it really is a mechanism for vegetation change. And I think hopefully people will start to realize, hey, this is a big deal.
Jonathan, what will you be working on next?
I'm really interested in what this means in terms of management possibilities. What I'm worried about is in our paper, we highlighted that even if we do get emissions under control, emissions of greenhouse gases, that is, we're still going to get some serious change. But I am an optimist, and as a scientist, I think we can manage that change and maintain the ecosystem services that are so critical for human life support. And that's what I really want to focus time on, is how can we do a much better job of managing the transformation that's already taking place in the West, and learning from that, hopefully be able to help manage the transformation in vegetation that is going to inevitably occur across the United States and around the planet. If we can manage it, I think we have a real chance of coming out of this okay. But implicit in this is that we just cannot allow greenhouse gas emissions to go unchecked. Because if we drive the vegetation too hard, too fast with big time warming, it could be just unmanageable.
And just on a personal note, you worked at the NASA Goddard Institute of Space Studies in the late 1980s. Did you meet James Hansen there?
In fact, Jim Hansen was the guy who recruited me to come to NASA GIS. And it's kind of funny because in this context, is what he wanted me to do back in the late 80s was to help his team, which is trying to model all the changes that were coming down the pike, to try and build in dynamic vegetation into their climate model. And I was just fresh PhD, figured I could figure anything out. And, you know, I learned pretty quick that the job I was tasked with doing was an exceedingly difficult job. And in fact, even to this day, I think our new paper in Science shows that our models of global vegetation are still too primitive to give us the kind of information we need to manage or anticipate and manage future change. But without any doubt, you know, my chance to meet Jim Hansen really changed my life, because I realized at that point, you know, it was that era when he was testifying before Congress in the summer of 88, you know, saying climate change is happening. And it really sunk in for me, you know, that this was going to be my career, trying to understand this incredible thing we're doing to the planet, hopefully get out the word about what we're doing, and hopefully understand it well enough to manage it and to prevent the worst things from happening. And that set the stage for my career probably as much as anything.
That's a beautiful circle that he got you going on that, and here you are with one of the important papers along with your team of 42 scientists. We have been speaking with one of the great American climate scientists, in my opinion, Dr. Jonathan Overpeck, and his long title, he's the Samuel A. Graham Dean and William B. Stapp Collegiate Professor of Environmental Education at the School for Environment and Sustainability at the University of Michigan. The paper we've been discussing is titled Past and Future Global Transformation of Terrestrial Ecosystems Under Climate Change, as published in the journal Science, August 31st, 2018. You can find all the links you need in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Jonathan Overpeck, thank you so much for sharing this valuable time with us.
It was a pleasure talking with you. Thank you. I think it's great that you're able to go into this level of detail. It's not often that that occurs, and I think it's an important thing, what you're doing.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.